So, dude, have you ever wondered why literally everyone talks like this? And is it like a problem? While we might find some speech patterns, especially those of younger people, annoying, Valerie Friedland argues these verbal tics might actually be healthy signs of a dynamic, evolving language in the new book, Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English. Valerie teaches linguistics at the University of Nevada in Reno and writes a popular language blog for Psychology Today. Here she is to share five of her big ideas.
Hello, this is Valerie Friedland. I'm the author of the new book, Like Literally, Dude, Arguing for the Good and Bad English. In my day job, I'm a professor of linguistics, and I have spent years researching the way that language shapes and is shaped by who we are, and how this impacts the course of language over time. But whenever I would talk to non-academics, I noticed that I was peppered with questions revolving around the decaying state of English, suggesting that those of us who study language scientifically had done a pretty poor job of translating what we knew about language to the people that actually use it. To tackle this problem, my new book uncovers the fascinating linguistic backstories of many of the speech features that we love to hate. And by unpacking the science and the psychology behind the way we speak, I hope to share with you what I have learned about the power and the purpose behind them. So let's dive right into some of the key takeaways of Like Literally, Dude. The first big idea: there is more than one way to look at language. Most of us can recall a time when we've heard somebody say something we find annoying. Maybe it's hearing literally used non-literally or the omnipresent dudes and likes that populate our teens talk. But what if everything you've learned about what language should be is based only on one very narrow and surprisingly recent perspective? Prescriptivism, the idea that particular features of language are correct while others are not, has only truly characterized English since about the 18th century, when the loosening of strict class boundaries and the rise of the middle class made language one of the last discerning markers of aristocracy. This coincided with an intense focus on the standardization of English, mainly by members of the upper class who used their own norms and beliefs about what was good and bad in the process. But as someone who has learned to look at language as a linguist, focusing on the science and the history behind the way we talk, I am less interested in what we have come to believe about language and more interested in what we have come to know about language. For example, many of us believe there are five vowels in English. In fact, I bet you're reciting them in your head right now. A-E-I-O-U, and of course that's sometimes Y. But if we can get what we were taught in school out of our heads for just a minute, we will see that English actually has many more vowels than this, not the five we've been duped into believing it has. Say beat, bit, bait, bet, bat, bot, bout, boat, butt, boy, bite, book, and boot. Whew, that's a lot. The only difference among those words is the vowel sounds they contain, which means that English must have well over five. But written English, which does rely on five letters that combine in different ways to represent the multiplicity of vowel sounds that we say in those words, has misled us all these years. Indeed, a lot of what we tend to think of as language so-called rules are actually just social preferences that we've developed based on the written language forms. But if we step back to consider what a perspective based on linguistic science might offer us, we'll see that the speakers who bring new forms and fashions into English are not breaking any true articulatory or cognitive rules, but instead following the tide of linguistic evolution. And this brings us to our next big idea, which is that language evolution does not happen in a vacuum. It requires the help of some serious social influencers. But the movers and shakers of the linguistic world are probably not who you would expect. Language evolves because social forces, be it invasions, migration, cultural shifts, or even the social soup that is middle and high school, act as triggers in taking the underlying linguistic tendencies that we all have as speakers of a human language and giving them social meaning. But when we look at research on who instigates these new features of speech, what we find is the same groups throughout history have usually been at the helm of linguistic innovation, namely the young, the female, and the lower classes. For example, the early modern English shift from using verb forms like hath and doth to today's has and does was more prevalent in the letters written by those with lower social status and women, likely because they tended to be more informal and intimate. And in one of the first empirical studies of its kind, Linguist Louis Gachat found that young speakers, but especially young female speakers, were instigating changes in a French dialect spoken in a small Swiss village way back in 1905. More recently, when linguists looked at the restructuring of expressions of necessity, which involve a change-up from dusty old must to our more modern have or have got to, guess who led that way? Yup, you got it. The young, the female, and the so-called vulgar classes. Why? Because even though the progression of such changes is largely subconscious, these linguistic leaders are particularly cued into the value of language in crafting and navigating social identity. Now let's get to our next big idea, which is that there have been major plot twists along the way to how we speak now. In other words, though we might feel pretty smug in thinking we know the right form of English, sometimes language has done a complete 360 and we don't even know it. For example, how do you pronounce the ing ending on your progressive participles? That is, on words like walking and talking. Are you a fan of walking and talking or walking and talking? Most people would say that if one was aiming at correct speech, one should ing rather than in. But if you look back at the history of this verb ending, what we find is that in Old English, the progressive participle was formed not with an ing, but actually with an ind. Because of sound changes occurring a bit later in English, this ind or ind ending became easily confused with a coexisting ing or ing ending. And that ending was used to make verbal nouns, leaving us handy modern words like evening and blessing, but it didn't operate over verbs. That was the role of the ind. So using an in ending on our progressive verb is actually not sloppy English, but the original verbal ending. And we have decent evidence that up until about the 19th century, so-called good speakers didn't typically pronounce that G either. In fact, in the 18th century, writer Jonathan Swift, himself a bit of a grammar maven, wrote that learnin' and not learning was the proper pronunciation as used at court by the upper echelons of society. And it wasn't until the 19th century when we start to see in noted in texts with an apostrophe. And that suggests it's only at this point it began to be viewed as a vernacular or colloquial feature. So, the next time you judge someone for their ing, you might want to think twice. So this brings us now to our next big idea, which is that sometimes even bad features can do really good things. To see how this might be true, let's pause to consider those little ums and uhs that pop into our speech when we're hesitating. Surely those can't be helpful in any way. After all, we pay speaking coaches good money to help us keep them at bay. But what if I told you that research suggested those little filled pauses are unexpectedly helpful to both speakers and listeners? For one, they seem to help us with speech planning. They occur most often when we're doing hefty cognitive tasks. So, for example, before we say abstract, difficult, less familiar, or less common words, or when we've just started constructing the syntax of an impressively long sentence. Filled pauses also seem to play a communicative role, as they signal to a listener that there's going to be an upcoming speech delay. Even more fascinating is that they seem to communicate exactly how long of a delay our listener should expect, with research showing that precedes longer delays than So if they you probably have time to take a pause. But if they you might have time to go get a sandwich. And we haven't even gotten to the really good stuff yet. Sticking a filled pause before a word or phrase seems to act as a cognitive flag to a listener that they're going to need to ramp up their brain in order to integrate new information that's coming. For instance, when hearing an inserted before the name of an item that had not been mentioned before by researchers, listeners were quicker at selecting that object on a screen. As an added bonus, other research showed that listeners had better recall of words previously mentioned in an experiment when those words had followed a, yep, you guessed it, a filled pause when initially said. So, better communication, quicker processing, and a boost in memory? All that from a little pause? Not too shabby for something we think of as bad speech. And this leads to our final takeaway, our biggest idea yet, which is that language change is fundamental to who we are as humans. A lot of people scoff at the idea that the changes we hear in the speech around us are positive developments. But do you really believe that Beowulf represented the apex of English? I doubt it. But if we use language change as our measure of decline, then modern English certainly has a lot of explaining to do. We've moved from being a language of incredible complexity, with case, class, gender and number markings on pretty much every word imaginable, to one where we pretty much don't ever bother. But are we any less expressive or creative? We've invented air travel, the internet, and life-saving vaccines, all without the help of the complicated morphosyntax that once defined our language. Instead of pointing to society's downfall, the speech habits we love to hate today are part and parcel of how language has worked and evolved through centuries. And I think we've turned out pretty okay. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Valerie. That was Five Big Ideas from Like Literally Dude, Arguing for the Good in Bad English by Valerie Friedland. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for, listening.